Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, welcome to Tech Magic, the podcast where we talk about gaming, innovation, technology news, spatial computing, AI, of course, and everything in between. I am joined today by my guest co-host, Lee Keebler. Lee,
howdy,
how you doing?
It is full-blown allergy season in Portland, Oregon, so I am miserable right now. You would think with all of the advancements that man has made in the last, 100 years, that allergies would have been one of them, but they are not.
They are not.
They are not.
Well, you might be miserable, but I am having a great day. I am in Latin America for a couple of days.
Nice.
I'm shooting the magazine cover for another women's magazine. So CoverGirl,
cool.
Nice. Yeah. I like that. And weather here is gorgeous. Sunny.
Oh, we finally got the good weather. We got that too.
Okay.
So we're right there with you. Thus the allergy season is upon us because it is beautiful in Portland right now.
It's the time to go to Portland or what?
It is. Like the next 3 or 4 months is like that's
awesome.
That's why we all live here.
I'm in Latin America for a couple of days, then flying to Miami. And I'll be speaking on at an event called Summit at Sea, which is part of the Summit events. It's a very well-known event. It's about 2,000 visionaries, technologists, all these sorts of people on a Virgin Voyages cruise ship for 4 days. Yeah, it's going to be, I am so excited because it's not like a cruise with like regular like tourists. It's a cruise with all the people that you could find interesting. Right?
So
I'm doing a talk on spatial computing and AI wearables, AI that can see. The co-founders of Humane are going to be there, which, I met them in Barcelona. Lots of awesome folks have already reached out and they're like, I'm going to be on the ship. So we're all stuck on the ship for a couple of days. And I will tell you something funny. When you go to the Summit website, Summit at Sea, and you look at like the speaker placement, just like the way they structured it, the pictures, it's like, there's like a picture of a guy and then me. And then right after me, it's Diplo. So I'm like, oh,
wow. Oh
my God. I was like, I felt really proud of that. I was like, ooh la la. So yeah, very pumped about Summit at Sea. So I'll be reporting back next Monday on, we're recording Monday. Episodes drop Wednesday. So
yes. That's great. I'm always interested this sounds really crazy, but it's just part of like how I kind of grew up in Florida. I went on a lot of like cruises as a kid because we lived next to a port. The technology that has to go on those ships is just wild.
Yeah.
And now you can like actually have internet service and stuff out at sea, which to me is still like, I guess, satellites make sense, but I just remember when like you just couldn't get a phone call. No one, if you got on that boat, you were gone for 5 days and there was no communicating back home. So it's always interesting to see how those things grow.
Yeah. So I'll be reporting back. I don't think I'm going to go off ship at all. I think I'm going to stay on the ship because there's so much to do. So many interesting people. Like I cannot wait. Summit at Sea, we'll definitely be sharing some thoughts on that. But we got a lot of news to cover today, and we also have a guest interview. So,
wait, who's the guest interview? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. We have Andrew Rosen from Parkour. He also writes a column for The Information, and he's been writing, he writes a lot about the streaming companies in Hollywood. He had a great article about media executives wanting to do gaming and being ill-equipped. So great content. We had a real, it's definitely a discussion worth listening to, because he's so knowledgeable about the streaming world and how everything's kind of converging in that sense. So
much change happening right now. And I think we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the show too.
Yeah. So we're recording April 1st, right? So April Fools. I will tell you, like, I'm going to ask you, have you seen any interesting April Fool's jokes out there?
Yeah.
Anything cool?
Nintendo.
Ooh.
Nintendo's, it's obvious, like, they're not fooling anybody. Like, that's fine. But it was such a cool little video where they made fun of the Virtual Boy Pro. They said they were bringing the Virtual Boy Pro, and it is so well done. It is a cute video where it's one of those rare moments where Nintendo's not taking themselves and their IP seriously.
Yeah.
So that's what you just kind of like about it. You basically strap a Nintendo Switch on your head and it goes through and shows you they're making fun of the Apple Vision Pro.
Yeah.
100%. Because everything that they show is not VR. It is absolutely mixed reality, AR, spatial computing. And so they're showing you what you could do with like Animal Crossings, where you take like your Animal Crossings furniture and place it in your real space. And you're wearing it while driving and you see Luigi in the next car and you're playing Mario Kart, but you're actually in real traffic and it causes like a car wreck. And the best part, and I'm not going to give it away, is at the very end. So if you haven't seen it, go look up the Virtual Boy Pro video for Nintendo, because it is hilarious. It was so very well done. That was my favorite today.
That's awesome. I will definitely be looking at it. I'll give you mine. So Gary Marcus, who I've brought up several times, I need to have him on the podcast. Like, we need to interview him. But he's an AI researcher, and you know, he's at NYU. He has a newsletter called Marcus on AI, and he has a very interesting perspective. I like listening to a balanced view, like the very positive person and the people that are like, this is not really what people are talking about. He wrote one, and he said, OpenAI just gave me a sneak preview, early access of GPT-5 to do some red teaming, and it's incredible. And then in the whole, the paragraphs are like how amazing it is. I haven't spotted any hallucinations. I'm impressed. I'm so glad they're going back to being open. And then says Gary Marcus hopes you will read all the way to the end. And says, P.S. This entire message was written and posted on April Fool's Day. So, oh my gosh, it was so good, because when I got it, I read it and I was like, oh my gosh. What a different tune. This does not sound like Gary. And then, of course, boom, April Fool's joke.
Well, and it might come back to bite a little bit, because I've read a couple of articles with Sam Altman saying like, yeah, ChatGPT has gotten worse. Things are broken and they're fixing it. And the next iteration should be very well streamlined. And I've been one of the louder voices that have been saying like, yo, this junk is broken right now, and it has gotten really bad.
It was bad again last week, wasn't it?
It's nearly impossible to use right now.
Yeah.
It's just there's some hilarious stuff just floating around on TikTok of like people yelling at ChatGPT trying to get it to like put out images, and it just can't.
It won't do it.
It won't do it. There's the one I saw this week. My wife shared it with me. Was this guy who's trying to get an image of fried rice, and it kept without peas in it, and you can't do it. Like, the system will not create an image of fried rice without peas in it.
Okay.
And he's just yelling at the screen, and I've been in that position of like, what are you doing?
Just
define this.
Okay. You can do this. Oh my gosh, it's so crazy.
Those are the moments where I'm just like, anyone who thinks that this is the end all be all solution to something today is not paying attention.
Yeah, not right now, for sure.
No, not right now.
Okay, so definitely let's start with some AI news, because I feel like it's, oh my gosh, every week it's just so intense with anything AI, right?
It's going to be this way for a while.
Yeah.
It's 1993. This is the internet, right? Like,
should we rename the podcast AI Magic?
No, please. No.
You'll head for the exit. Yeah. Okay. So some news happened last week and over the weekend. The CEO of Stability AI has stepped down. And
yes, so I'm unfamiliar with this story. We talked about it a little bit when it happened. I'm unfamiliar with it. Mm-hmm. I was unfamiliar with the CEO here. This was not of all of the AI platforms that I've been evaluating and leverage and even pay for. To be honest, Stability AI was not one of them.
Yeah.
So fill everyone in because I don't know anything about this one.
I mean, they were one of the first ones out of the gate, like the one of the darlings. Like it was one of those companies that everyone's like putting OpenAI, Stability AI, like all in the same group. And I actually got to meet the CEO at an event last year in August. He gave a really interesting talk. He seemed like a visionary. Like if you see him on stage, he seems like a visionary and et cetera. And I'm not saying he isn't. I'm just saying apparently there was a lot of news that came out about maybe, you know, a lot of employees being very upset about how the company was being run. Some of the top people leaving right before. Some people complaining, saying that they were going to leave if he didn't step down. There was also information in Forbes that came out on the burn rate, like a crazy burn rate. Because they raised a lot of money. They raised quite a bit.
Yeah.
But the burn rate was ridiculous. And I remember saying something like, they had only like $4 million left. I mean, that's not enough to run an AI company at this point, right? Because of the compute power. So I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. And I don't know if, you know, what Forbes reported seems to be corroborated. But I don't know if they had $4 million or not left. But just a lot of change.
Now, he was the first person I've seen in article to... at least in like what would be considered more of a mainstream conversation and part of it based on his, you know, his exit, to bring forth the concept that I'm passionate about of decentralizing artificial intelligence. This is a concept that I've been following since like 2020, and have been writing about it and have been kind of trying to talk to people about it, but it's such a weird esoteric thought, that I think we're still a couple of years away from it being a valid conversation. But it, and again, a lot of what I have a hard time talking about it because it's like a lot of what's happening also with like our internet laws could impact decentralizing a lot of things because you're basing it on being able to share it across multiple machines, which could be in different state lines. So, but it is interesting that like that was his exit announcement was that he was going towards a completely different way of distributing an artificial intelligence and probably one of the only ways I can think of where if successful, all of our AI laws are thrown out the window. Like there's just no, you can't stop it at that point. Like it's the ability to regulate a decentralized system that is scraping the internet to build whatever models it wants is, I don't want to say it's scary. That's not the right word, but it could be.
It could be a Pandora's box. I mean,
it's absolutely a Pandora's box. Obviously. You can't close it. Once it's open, it's going to be open.
Yeah. So, we'll keep our eyes on what's going on with them, right? And see what happens with Stability AI. We know what he launches next, that decentralized AI initiative that he wants to look into. So we'll definitely keep everyone updated. Other things happening in the AI space. Lego is the latest brand to apologize for using AI. You have a lot to say about this. I'm going to let you take it because I know you felt very strongly about this.
It's just such a silly conversation of Lego getting caught using AI that is obviously scraped their own data without their permission. And then, like, internally, there's this string of tweets or what the heck do we call an X now? I don't know what that's.
Just say tweets. It's fine.
Tweets. Oh, there's just a string of tweets from, like, people within the company saying, this isn't cool. We didn't know. Where's this coming from? And it's just this company that has routinely been like militantly protective of their intellectual property. There have been well-documented ongoing legal cases between like Lego and Roblox because the Roblox characters back when it launched in like 2007 look like Lego characters. And there was that, and it's a big part of why like Lego showing up on Roblox is probably not going to happen like in any meaningful way. I don't know. Like maybe they'll figure things out, but they are so protective over the little Lego guy IP. So the fact that they used AI to generate their marketing materials, which is still illegally scraping. Now, it's a gray area. I don't know if it's illegally scraping, but it is absolutely scraping their intellectual property for them to do that. It's just silly.
It is. But, you know, it was really funny because it's like they apologize, but they're still using it. It's like, okay, it's okay, but we're still going to keep using it. So I don't know. I'm glad they apologized, though, because people noticed. Right.
And well, it's in the comments, right? When you look at these images, there's one of like a ninja dressed Lego character that's cooking. And the number one comment is like, okay, what is in the character's hand? Is it a spoon or a spatula? It is some type of
some AI contraption. It was like, what is that? Actually, that's a great guessing game. Like, that's a really fun guessing game to have. Like, what is this? What are they cooking? What are they doing? What are they holding?
Yeah, of all of the stuff that I didn't expect to see, Lego using AI for their marketing and then apologizing for it.
So I will make a comment. I do think that they cannot ignore Roblox in the long term. So they're, you know, at some point, they might have to do something. Like, that's my perspective. Roblox is just growing so much internationally. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know because they've made a really good step forward with like Fortnite. So it's not as if they haven't like kind of drawn their line in the sand, right? It's like, okay, if they can't play in this area, they're going to go look at this area. And to me, as it goes to like impact on a generation, both of those are very viable paths. And so I think they're still getting what they need from a marketing perspective in what would be considered like a player focused technology. But I would like to see them, like, it just seems like they should be able to come to an agreement with like Roblox and make something amazing, because it really looks like it fits.
100%. 100%. I'll give you like a little fun fact that is like Lego related, not related to gaming or AI. I'm just going to put it in here. But so some of my friends that work for Lego, their business cards are actually minifigures. They're minifigs.
Oh, that's cool.
With their name and their phone number and email. I was like, that is the best business card you could ever get. Like, of course, every event they go to, like, you know, they run everyone out of wants their business card.
Yeah,
everyone wants a minifig to take home to their kids.
Yeah.
So,
taking home to the kids. Yeah. It's the kids who get, sure.
So, that's what I did. I was like, hey, can you give me one of them? And I took a picture so I could keep her contact info, but then gave it to my son. But now it's actually on my desk at work. So anyway, I did keep it for myself. Oh my goodness. All right. So other stuff, the AI industry is steaming toward a legal iceberg of massive proportions. All right, we got legal scholars, lawmakers, and at least one Supreme Court justice agreeing that companies will be liable for the things their AI says and does. And the lawsuits are just beginning, as we know.
I've thought about this.
I know you think about this deeply.
I think about this a lot. I think I'm in favor of this.
Okay.
I think.
You think. Why? Elaborate.
Because if I run a company and I have an employee that does something just crazy, like they go on a bender and just like ruin the company's reputation on social media or something, or in the act of their job as customer service, just lose their mind, I have the responsibility of that employee and I have the ability to fire that employee. And then that employee, and that is part of the, you know, process of handling a company's, you know, outward perspective to a client or customer. if I'm a company and I am employing AI as a overarching system and tool, and that AI does a thing that it shouldn't do, which could be considered like, which pulls in a legal ramification, I do not have the ability to just disconnect that AI. I mean, I guess technically I would, but like there's no one who's actually being held liable for whatever action took place. So it is the company's machine, therefore the company is responsible for it and for what it does, right? It is as if, like, let's say I'm Boeing, you know, and I fail to do certain security inspections.
Yep.
I would be held responsible for that.
Yes.
And part of that responsibility would also fall back on the employee who should have been doing X, Y, and Z to make sure that those safety checks are taken in place. If I employ a machine using AI to fill in those gaps and I remove the human factor out of it, now there's no human to fire, right? Like there's no one, so there's still a liability issue. So yes, I kind of see where this is. Could it be another Pandora's box? 100%. Is there something I'm missing here? I'm almost certain. But yeah, at some point you're just you're employing a machine to do a thing for your company, and therefore the company is responsible for its output. Plain and simple.
Yeah, or the company should, definitely. And you bring up a good point, right? I want to mention something that I saw posted by Dr. Jeffrey Funk, who, you know, he's a technology consultant and does a lot of work with AI. He posted, in one survey of 100 Fortune 1000 IT leaders, 100% are concerned about the security risk of the technology, and 98% have paused Gen AI projects. In a second survey, which reports more optimism, nearly all respondents reported adoption being slowed primarily by fears around the security and privacy of the technologies, regulation, and skills gap. But also talked about unease around issues of safety. And then some of these companies starting to claw back some of the money that they were going to spend on Gen AI because of security reasons, because they still haven't seen necessarily all the results they want to see. I think it's an interesting moment to look at the AI industry.
And well, it was sold as a magic box.
Oh yeah.
Right. Like so there's a lot of, right. So like there's a lot of executive and let's be real. A lot of these companies are not building their own AI in house where they have control over it. So what is interesting about this legal iceberg that we're talking about here is almost all of these companies are outsourcing. So any legal ramification that happens on them can be or may be passed through to whichever, you know, language model service provider that they're utilizing, I would think, right? So if I'm a company and I hire an agency to do a marketing campaign, and for whatever reason, I get sued as a company for that marketing campaign, you would pass that through. Like you might have to deal with it on your own because it is your marketing campaign, right? With whoever is the plaintiff. But then once that's done, you would then turn around and you would go and sue the marketing agency and say, you just cost us, you know, $100,000 on this campaign. And that's because you didn't do your job or you didn't think through blah, blah, blah. So I could see that being similar in this case, where if I'm a company and I'm outsourcing an AI solution and that AI solution gets me sued, it seems like there would be a pass through or like a second, you know, lawsuit the other end of that.
Yeah. You bring up a really interesting point. I guess an analogy here is not in the AI space, but it was in the fashion industry. I don't know if you remember this case where Balenciaga had, you know, they hired an agency. Obviously, they work with a lot of agencies, right? But they hired this agency. They did this whole campaign for their new collection. Balenciaga has always been pushing the envelope. Like, they become edgier and edgier. But the problem with this campaign was the photos were of kids wearing some of the things, and they had leather. And then there were some images that were kind of disturbing. And there was even, I don't even know how this passed the bar with, you know, how the agency thought this was a good idea or how it passed the bar with anyone at Balenciaga, but there were these papers on the floor of cases of child pornography. Like, it was just the weirdest.
Holy cow. No, I missed this.
Oh, you missed it? I mean, it caused Balenciaga millions in sales. Like, I know, like, people like myself that love the brand, like, I stopped wearing it for a bit because I was like, I'm going to get a lot of heat if I'm wearing this. Because it was so explicit and so it was so weird. Like, there's no way you can look at those images and not feel strange. And then when you added all these little, let's call them gross Easter eggs in there, it just made it even worse. So that cost the brand a lot, right? A lot of the artists that were big spokespeople, like, separated themselves. Of course, Balenciaga, you know, blamed it on the agency, of course. They might have sued, I'm not sure. And then kind of reverted back. And obviously now they're back in good graces because they're, you know, they're doing great stuff. And, you know, I'm back to wearing my Balenciaga. But but yeah, it was a really strange moment. So there is something to learn there, like that analogy that you mentioned, because it did cost Balenciaga millions of dollars in sales, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're not taking a healthy, when we see articles like this, we're not really taking a healthy look at, like, what is really happening. And that is, a company is just basically employing a technology solution to continue providing some form of data output. Mm-hmm. Very boring way to kind of, like, break down a salacious headline. But that's why I say, like, I think this is the right call. Now, I mean, there might be things that happen that they are unaware of, or really the bigger issue is, like, as the laws change, what does that mean? As it stands right now, if you're employing a tool to do a service and then that service that you provide ends you up with a lawsuit, like, that's your responsibility. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, an AI engine or if it's, like, a word, you know, a WordPress website, like, whatever. It's just a tool. Mm-hmm. What you did with it is on you, you know.
Indeed, indeed. So, before we go on break, and we've got a guest interview this week, like I mentioned, before we go on break, I do want to talk about something non-AI related. Sam Bankman-Fried, the sentencing, he got a 25 year sentence.
Yep.
Obviously, a lot of people were keeping their eyes on what was going on. I think Elizabeth Holmes had gotten, was it 11, and they got reduced to 7 or something?
Well, this is technically a reduction because like the prosecutors were going for like 40 plus, like they were going hard. So 25, considering the amount of money that, you know, we're talking about here, depending on who you talk to.
Yeah.
You know, now I do think reading through the article, Sam Bankman-Fried's lawyers, they were asking way too low. Their expectation was like 4 and some change.
Yeah, no, just come, like, on. Come on. No way. Yeah, please. But I think they also looked at his behavior before the trial, during the trial, like everything. I was like, yeah, you don't do that. You just don't. And like his whole media, like this media, like media tour that he almost did, right? Like, I was
that was crazy.
What? Who's advising this person? This is so wrong.
Yeah, that dude was on anything. You know, if you wanted to talk to him, he was just out there, just Tweety Burton it. Like,
we should have,
like,
had him on the podcast.
What is going on? easy. Like, you know,
sure,
like,
sign me up.
It was wild, and you know what's crazy to me about that story?
What?
And this is because, like, growing up as a kid, and, like, I was a kid when, like, the O.J. Simpson trial was going on, and so I remember that being, like, the dominating headline forever. And I look at, like, Enron, when that was a dominating headline, you know, we've had, you know, these type of financial stories where it just, like, lived in the zeitgeist for a while. There was so much crazy going on when this was happening that it was always on page 6. It was never. So, like, all of this has just kind of happened, and I've had to go back and be like, wait, what did I miss? Because everything else was going insane at the same time when this type of story should have been the front page that everyone was talking about. And it's just, like, not even in the top 3 of what was going on when that was happening.
Yeah. So crazy. So anyway, we're going to go on break. After break, we are going to have that interview I mentioned with Andrew Rosen. Very much. I hope people will listen to it because it's a fantastic conversation. I wish I would have had more time with him. But yeah, let's go on break and then we'll have the interview.
Hold up. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right. So today I am joined by Andrew Rosen, the founder of Parkour and a columnist for The Information, and someone that I actually met through the DLD community and the DLD events. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm so excited. Last time I saw you, we were in Munich at the DLD event, which was great, right? Did you have a good time?
You did a terrific job. I did, but I thought you were terrific. I really, that's a must watch. It's really,
a good,
really good
talk. Yeah, lots of great things have come from that, I will say. So Andrew, for folks that might not know who you are, what you do, and many people do, but maybe some listeners don't, can you tell them a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. So I've been... The way they probably know me by now is just through The Information. I have a newsletter that they've been distributing. That was the first third-party newsletter to be distributed by them. That was about just over 2 years ago. And then I started also writing a monthly column for them called Medium Shift. So that's probably the way that they know me. Before that, I got my start in digital media in Viacom. In MTV digital media. And so it was really this whole dance between, the way to describe it is like a dance between federal and state, right? Which in other words, mm-hmm. that at the time, MTV networks had a lot of powerful brands. There was a centralized initiative to bring everybody into digital. And so I was with the centralized group. I was able to come in under a group that was led by Jason Hirschhorn, who you all may know from Media Redefined. And then it just kind of ended up being this dance within the Viacom ecosystem, where I ended up like consulting for, after working in centrally and working across all those brands, I started consulting for BET Digital for quite a while, for about like 5 to 7 years. And then within that time, it was really formative for me because I was watching a really powerful brand with a very valuable audience try to navigate mm-hmm. the wholesale economics, which were far better than the retail economics. And so what I was witnessing in all that was just a management team who was super smart, but didn't have all the skills for a retail first media world. And so it was through that, both just having that experience and having friends who are in the D2C marketplace, that I started to realize, started to get a lens where I started writing a newsletter. And then I switched to a subscription model in 2019. And fast forward 5 years and here I am.
And you work with a lot of executives in the media space. You bring them insight. You tell them, you kind of help navigate this this new minefield. It feels like a minefield right now, to be honest. I'm an avid reader of your, especially your column in The Information. And you and I actually connected because you wrote something called Media Executives Covet Games, but Are Ill-Suited to Run Them. And I said, you literally said what a lot of us in the gaming space have known for a long time and understand. When you were writing that column, like, what did you learn? Because like it was such a good perspective on how everyone wants the gaming money, but very few people understand that in order to do that, they need to understand gaming culture, or at least attempt to try to understand it.
Yeah, I mean, I'd been thinking about it a lot, and I found that what I'd learned was, I talked to the germ of it came from, I mean, I'd always known this. I mean, everybody had always known this, but you know, what you saw was Warner Brothers Discovery increasingly relying on games. And I'll come back to that in a second. And then there was the rumor that like ESPN would do something with EA. And, mm-hmm. I talked to some people and it was that the guy who runs EA Sports was really, really hungry to find a way to do something with ESPN. And then on the flip side of it, this is all hearsay, but it was like, but on the flip side of it, there was the, you have to start thinking about mm-hmm. when we start looking at that business from a retail first perspective. Right. And the key thing is, and one of the most important things that I've learned in what I do is that what streaming is relative to gaming, it's like mm-hmm. the 101. If gaming is the 401, right. That, between the marketing, between the consumer relationship, yeah. between the monetization models, streaming's really basic. But they both start from the same relationship with the customer, right? That you have somebody in a database, you're understanding their attachment to, just to quote Jason Kyler, the former head of Warner Media, mm-hmm. their beloved characters or their beloved worlds, and you're trying to monetize that. And so when I was writing that, the question was, okay, is this the moment, right? Is this the moment mm-hmm. where legacy media executives understand that basic Venn diagram overlap that happens in a database somewhere in the cloud? And the answer is obviously no. And when I spoke to one executive who's one of my subscribers, he said, it's very simple. They're not gamers. Like they don't think like we think. They don't have an understanding of what we do. And, there's a long history of Disney struggling with gaming. Warner Brothers Discovery has a really, the thing I totally forgotten, but now that I'm talking, it was the thing that was the really was kind of the catalyst for the piece. Cause I've been thinking about all these things, but it was Jessica Reif Ehrlich on the earnings call with Warner Brothers Discovery. And, David Zaslav is talking up games and her basic question was, why do you think that this is going to compensate for all the things that are going wrong?
Yeah.
And he didn't really have a good answer. And in large part, the thing is logically he wasn't wrong, right? That's mm-hmm. pretty much where the relationship with the audience was going. But from a pure like economics, P&L, whether or not these were the guys to take the business to where it needs to go, her basic question was, you guys are TV guys and now you're talking about gaming. Like where do you think this is headed? And why should we believe you? And so I thought that's what made it an opportune time to talk about it.
And I think it was kind of almost visionary in some ways, because fast forward a couple of months, you have, Disney announcing a big investment, let's say $1.5 billion, which is, a lot of money, but not too much nowadays with AI being crazy. But, their investment into Epic Games and building kind of a universe. They don't want to use the word metaverse, right? But kind of that investment and then Disney going heavily into gaming in this way. What was your thought when you read that? When you read Disney's investing in Epic, they're going, they're looking at gaming as that next frontier. They're going to look at how to extend their streaming IP into all these sorts of things. So,
yeah, I've spent a lot of time with Disney's history, right, in digital efforts. And there's really three, if you want to boil it down, which is number one, the Disney Interactive Studio, which they shut down. And 9 years later, the studio that they spun off just made the Hogwarts Legacy. the second one is the Maker Studios, which was a $625 million investment. And then they had to, 2 years later, that had to close down. And then the third is streaming, which, they have a very, they are really fighting to try and build a good story. But if you look at Nielsen data, it's not a great story. People don't have real attachment to the service the way they do to a Netflix. Or even like an Amazon Prime. Amazon Prime has much better data. And so the challenge in that history was whether or not the operational culture was open to the new technology. And in all of those instances, there was something of the DNA, something about the DNA in the culture that just couldn't quite map to the new technology, right? Like in gaming, obviously, it just didn't work internally. It was better to license it. In Maker Studios, nobody really wanted to experiment with the medium. They were very risk averse about the brand. With streaming, they've really pushed themselves to trying to adapt to the marketplace, but they also launched the service with Iger was quoted in the Wall Street Journal saying this 5 years ago. It's like he didn't want personalization because he believed if people want Mickey Mouse, and I think if people are clicking on Mickey Mouse and I think they want Mickey Mouse. which was a total misread of what the ecosystem was and the way that it worked. You know, it's ultimate because you have to go to the logical question is, well, if they don't want Mickey Mouse, what else do you have? And if they like Mickey Mouse and they don't want to watch Mickey Mouse, then what else you got? Mm-hmm. And if the answer is, well, I think they wanted more Mickey Mouse, then you've got a service that's going to really struggle with engagement and growth. And that's what we have. And so the Epic Games thing, to me, I was skeptical for that reason. But, you know, you sort of have to test that. And the amusing anecdote I have is that Digiday had a good piece on the Epic Games, on the Epic Games deal and whether or not it was a game changer. And when you read it, they say, all right, like, well, how is this thing actually going to work?
Yeah.
Because the details, you know, it's a really well-written press release in terms of like management preservation. But in terms of like how this thing's actually going to work, it says nothing. And so Digiday said, hey, it says nothing. Let's ask them what they have, like what they're going to tell us in addition to the press release. And the line they have in the piece is management directed us back to the press release. Mm-hmm. And so there is, to me, the thing that I don't fully know, and I don't think Disney fully knows because they haven't focused on that Venn diagram overlap of streamers and gamers is, well, what do gamers actually want from Disney and the metaverse? And, you know, is it millions of people worldwide or is it like a few hundred thousand who are just going to really enjoy it? Because one of those is worth $1.5 billion as an investment. Mm-hmm. And the other is just going to be the same old song that you've seen over the past 15 years. And so it's the challenge in all this comes back to the point that they're not gamers, right? Like mm-hmm. they just don't like somebody like Bob Iger does not see the world from a database first perspective. He sees it much more from scale has been aggregated for him. How does he monetize it optimally? Mm-hmm. Even like even that great anecdote he tells in his book, The Ride of a Lifetime, about holding the video iPod for their first time and realizing that Disney had to be a part of that. That's just a distribution deal. Like that's all that's what his mind put together. But if you ask him like what, you know, what his consumers want and what they don't want, the tragedy in this whole story is that that's the way Bob Chapek thinks and thought mm-hmm. as CEO. And I think that in that sense, Chapek was absolutely right. I'm happy to concede all the complaints from creatives about Chapek, but I do think that like, if you want to know where the world is headed, Bob Chapek understands it and Bob Iger doesn't.
Yeah. That's so interesting. And I feel like there's this, we're at this moment, right, as well. Gaming, everything happening. I mean, AI, obviously it's top of mind for everyone right now. You have a great article on the media revolution will be prompted. I was recently reading about how OpenAI is going to Hollywood. They're showing Sora and giving this tool to all these people. You've got, you know, Tyler Perry saying he's no longer building an $800 million expansion of his, you know, sound stages because of AI. You're very close to this world in some ways. What are you seeing when it comes to how they're thinking about AI?
Yeah, the angle on this one, and it was this particular piece was the like instigator for it, or whatever spurred the idea was that there was an interview between these two YouTube creators named Colin Chowdhury and Sameer Chowdhury and Colin Rosenblum, and they interviewed the CEO of YouTube, Neil Mohan, and in the interview they say, look, like, we're worried about flooding of AI generated content on our platform. Yeah. There's this creator named Quebblecop, who's a gaming AI creator who started using AI generated, literally like an AI generated persona. And then after creating the AI generated persona, 3 months later was using like a human version of his persona. And he said, you know, this guy is able to upload so easily. I was able to automate everything. Like, why wouldn't the algorithm just start mm-hmm. favoring his content because he's a creator? Totally reasonable question. Mohan demurred, sort of was like, yeah, I don't really see the concern, but sure. And so this particular piece actually involved me doing journalism and interviewing these people. So I actually got to interview Sameer Chowdhury and I got to interview Quebblecop, Jordy Maxim Vandenbosch. And there was a common theme to what they were saying, which is they thought that AI generated content inevitably is going to be on these platforms. Mm-hmm. there's going to be some divergence in the next 3 to 5 years where it's going to be something like a Sora, where it's prompt to video platform that's going to have to be separate from YouTube, because just for a whole bunch of reasons. And they'll probably they'll probably isolate AI generated content to that platform too. But you know, the point that Samir made, which is a really profound point, is that we've all been conditioned already for this experience because we type text in to figure out what we want to watch into Netflix or into YouTube or into TikTok or wherever. And so you're going to get to a place with Sora where you can basically say, I want to watch a funny movie that's 5 minutes long about, you know, two giraffes fighting, right? I mean, it'd be something like that.
Yeah.
And the use case is going to be the entertainment, but it's also going to be the length, right? Like, you don't really ask YouTube for a 5 minute clip about whatever topic you're interested in. You find the topic you're interested in, you see how long it is. I'm sure there are people out there who look for the time length too, but I gotta understand your audience a little bit better. They probably do that, but the basic point
they might
is
do that. Yes.
Yeah. But the point is that you're going to get to a point where that's going to emerge and it's going to be a compelling entertainment use case. I think there's a Sora video that just came out today of somebody with a balloon head, and it was like a few minutes long. It was actually super compelling and interesting.
Yeah.
Is it something that I would watch instead of Shogun on Hulu? No. But will I watch it? Probably. And as long as I watch it, that is my attention that's being diverted from YouTube and from Netflix towards something that's a very similar product. And so we're just the place that those interviews got me was, you know, you have to start thinking now of like, okay, prompt to video is going to be a real thing. What does that mean? I mean, the next piece I'd like to write, I just have to sit down and do the actual journalism again, is I'll sort of walk through a use case that came up through my own newsletter, right? Which is Steamboat Willie is a Mickey Mouse that is now fair use.
Yeah.
So I can actually do a prompt to text Steamboat Willie, make me a Steamboat Willie. Well, first I could definitely do an image, right? So there's actually a Mickey image out there. If you say, show me a Mickey with a sword, they'll do the Steamboat Willie Mickey with a sword. Mm-hmm. Now let's see you animate that, right? So show Steamboat Willie sword fighting. Steamboat Willie sword fighting. Shows him sword fighting. Then you do another fair use case. You say, all right, I want Steamboat Willie Mickey sword fighting Winnie the Pooh. I don't think there's anything that preempts them that outcome, because it's as long as it doesn't look like it's a Disney product and it doesn't say Disney on it, that's allowed. But then you say, all right, I want them recreating the Black Knight scene from Monty Python on the Holy Grail, right? So it's Winnie the Pooh, Steamboat Willie Mickey recreate the Black Knight scene from Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Can they do that? And that to me is, because to me, that's actually something I'd want to watch, right? It's kind of a funny idea.
Yeah, funny, yeah.
But can I do that on a prompt to video platform? And right now, I think there's a lot of questions around fair use. And the only reason why I mentioned the Monty Python is, if you remember in the early days of YouTube, they were actually fine with people uploading their clips and talking about them. Mm-hmm. You're getting to a place where it sounds like a compelling use case, but the closer you get to it, the more that intellectual property law and copyright law get in the way of it.
Yeah. It gets complicated really fast.
Really
I agree.
Fast.
So I'm keeping my eyes on like all these, you know, potential rulings that might come from the courts around IP and AI. You've got laws left and right trying to find a way to regulate this. The AI Act in Europe. You've got Tennessee passing the Elvis Act, to try to I don't know how they're going to even enforce that, but try to regulate someone copying an artist's voice. You've got, you know, in Florida, the ban that they just did for, I think it's called SB3. We talked about it on the show, children over 14 being able to have access to social. And that actually, that has actually other implications for social and streaming as well. So like we arrive at this really complicated moment. Are you hopeful that media is going to figure it out?
I'll make the simplest version of the argument that I've made, which is a lot of what we understand as the media business is the function of what I call free money. Now, what do I mean by free money? The thing that I didn't appreciate until literally, you know, I'm in my late 40s, so I would say in the past 2 years, is that Blockbuster basically funded all the cultural moments of like the early 90s, right? I mean, everything from Dazed and Confused to, you know, Quentin Tarantino to like that whole indie filmmaker movement. In other words, there were people who were able to take risks because, number one, there was just additional money floating around because the rental market had been such a ridiculous boon, right? That, you know, you're, I mean, Blockbuster to replace a video cassette would pay $65 a cassette, right? So that money goes back to the studio, the studio goes back to producers, and all of a sudden there's just this money that nobody anticipated that they can use to invest in more projects. And then number two, there was a new distribution window in DVDs and VHS that people can monetize. And so something like Dazed and Confused would be in the theaters or Swingers, and then it would be a cult hit on DVD. And then the DVD market went from sort of what was originally just supposed to be like a way for people to buy DVDs, but then Blockbuster and Netflix figured out how to continue to rent them. So there was just free money until like 2007, 2008, and then zero interest rate policy kicked in. And all of a sudden there's a whole new free money that venture capital could access, that studios could access. And so even more content was being funded. The business, there was at some point, the disconnect that happened, and I'm doing mostly from like a media, from like streaming and traditional media perspective, but at some point the returns on streaming didn't really create the types of returns that DVDs and VHS created. And there's I'm sure there's a way to model. I'm sure somebody's modeled this out. I just don't have it in front of me or in the back of my mind. But the basic point is that at some point, a movie that went to the pay window of streaming or went to a proprietary owned and operated streaming platform just wasn't making the same type of money as it used to on alternative pay windows that had done 5-10 years before. And so now there's just less money going into entertainment. And then there's cord cutting taking place. Cord cutting was a whole other form of subsidy, right? Linear was a whole form of subsidy that you just had people spending money blindly for month after month.
Yeah.
Like millions of people just spending, like, you know, like there were cable channels that got a dollar that were never watched, a dollar per month from like 50 million, 70 million homes. That's crazy, right? That's crazy that happened, but it happened. And so now that's gone, or that's going. I mean, there's still 50 to 60 million households, but that's going. And so we're at this moment where the fundamental question is, first, like, where's this money going to come from? Then second, like, what are the businesses that are going to actually know how to monetize it? And we have like the structure of one answer to the monetization question, which we were starting at, right? Which is somebody has to fundamentally understand what a business looks like, where in the database, you have people who like gaming and they like streaming, and there's a way to monetize them. Like the path that Jason Kyler was talking about, that when you listen to him, his logic actually makes a lot of sense, was that, you know, if you think about it from a perspective of like pure average revenue per user, ARPU, you're going to get recurring revenues from a streaming customer. And if they really, really love the IP that you own, you're going to get some sort of distorted amount of money from them because, the way that gaming apps perform in app stores, like you can make 50% of your money from like the top, 1% of users or something. I mean, like it just ends up being this distortive source of revenue. And like you should pursue that, but you have to understand the relationship with the customer first and foremost. And most of these guys don't.
Yeah. Ooh, this is such a fantastic conversation. I've got, before we go, I got two questions for you.
Yes.
And try to answer them as best you can. So you've also been writing about the creator economy, right? You kind of, in one of your columns, you talk about Mr. Beast. Obviously, the news came out that Mr. Beast has a giant deal with Amazon Prime. How do you see this, the role of the creator, right? The creator economy and the role of the creator as it starts to merge with streaming in a new way?
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to something that Samir Chowdhury said to me, which is that ultimately, like, the only creators who really survive are the best storytellers. Mm-hmm. Like, the people who are in real trouble right now are the people who call themselves creator, but they can't tell a story. Like, that there's something, and you know, the thing that Mr. Beast has figured out is how do you map human storytelling to an algorithm? Like, there's a lot of criticism for him for embracing the algorithm, but that's not what he's doing. He's basically saying, here are stories that we've been told before. I mean, I think somebody analogized what he does to like MTV reality shows, and I think it's right. Mm-hmm. But that, like, that, how do you tell those stories today through YouTube? And so he's really compelling at that. Will it be compelling on Amazon Prime? I don't know, right? I don't know if like that. That's a very interesting question. He thinks he, I mean, he sounds like he thinks he's got a solution. There's no reason to question him, but there's always reason, just reasonable skepticism, to, because there's yet to be a case where a creator left YouTube and was more successful on like traditional media. So I think that that's really the fundamental issue right now for the creator economy, which is, number one, like, the storyteller is going to be the one that they're going to survive, and they have to figure out how to, you know, to be good storytellers in these new media. And then number two, there's just this whole sort of middle class to, I mean, there's really no middle class, right? And so, and then there's, and so there's just this drop off. Like, to, like the number I always like to quote is, they say there's like 3 million subscribers. There are 3 million channels in the partner program. Let's say the, what, like if you do the 0.01%, right? That's like 30,000 channels. Are there 30,000 creators?
There's so many more.
So actually, well, hold on. So it's 30. So, but 10% is 300,000. 1% is,
10%, yeah, it's a very small amount. It's a very, very
small amount. It's like 30,000. That's right.
Giant mountain of creators that exists. Right. So.
And if you can get down to like 2,000 creators, 3,000 creators, like, are there 3,000 creators out there who are pushing the needle? And I don't even think that's the answer, right?
Like, I don't,
Are there? I don't think they exist. And so there's a very weird, there's something wrong with that number that they quote, right? That there's sort of outsized talent. I mean, it's not even like the traditional, you know, long tail, right? There's like, there's no head. Like, if there's a head of a tail, like, the drop off seems to be extraordinarily.
The drop off is extraordinary, and I think, and even Mr. Beast has alluded to that, like all these YouTubers kind of leaving the platform. So before I leave you, one last question, very quickly: are you seeing? We talk a lot about spatial computing, Apple Vision Pro. Do you see any interest from traditional media into going into spatial computing? Obviously, Disney. You know, Bob Iger was on stage with Tim Cook, like. Do you truly think that they're serious about going into spatial computing?
You know, I will say this, watching the demos of Apple Vision Pro and seeing like the multi-window experience, if I were a legacy media executive, I'd be very, very scared, because it's, it takes the best possible experience from my content and it commoditizes it, right? Like, I think it is awesome to sit on a plane and be able to have the biggest screen possible. But in every one of those videos of people who's doing that, they have like TikTok on one side, they have chat on the other. They've got, I mean, like their heads.
Guilty as charged.
Right. Like there's no, it's such a cool use case that unfortunately, because of the smartphone and laptop era, like, is just going to be marginalized. And I don't know. So I don't, if you're a media executive, I don't know what you do with that. I think a lot of these guys are probably horrified at that. The thing that they thought would be, you know, like all these guys, there was actually, I'll tell you very quickly, the Deloitte 18th annual digital media trends report just came out. And in the report, they're very gently say, look, I don't like, you know, a lot of executives are proposing putting all these pay TV elements onto, onto streaming. And it's not what people want, you know, like, it's so
not what the consumer wants. That's for not, sure.
Not, like, that's not what they're saying. Like, which is another way of saying, like, the people who really understand this stuff would never pursue the Apple Vision Pro as a distribution medium, assuming that it would be a new distribution medium. They would really think about it as like a whole new medium, right? Again, the database first approach. Yeah. Like, you know, if somebody on the Apple Vision Pro, if they want to watch a movie in a big way, like, what else do they need that they would pay for? Because if you can figure that out, then you can capture, you can have a whole division focused on a really active base that really loves spatial computing and really loves watching movies on a big screen and probably loves paying for something else. And these guys, just because they've come up as in the linear and cable era and theatrical distribution era, like, they just don't think that way. And the fact that they don't think that way is not a negative about them, right? Like, it's just their strengths lie elsewhere. That's not unusual. It's just this moment where they won't let go. Mm-hmm. Right? Like none of these guys want to let go to power. And you're thinking,
they don't want to let go. Yeah. The longer, well, that's going to come back to haunt them though.
Well, yeah.
You know,
it already has
in some ways. I don't know. But Andrew, thanks for joining the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Where can folks connect with you? Where can they find you?
Easiest place to find me is LinkedIn. I think it's with the LinkedIn and then the N and then the slash. Then
we'll include a link for sure.
Yeah, we'll do that. I'm AAGAVE at Agave on Twitter. And then just, you can find me at PARQOR.com, parkour. Mm-hmm. And you can sign up for my newsletter there and learn a little bit more about what I'm up to.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
All right. So that was our interview with Andrew Rosen. Just enlightening when it comes to understanding how some of these streaming companies, some of these media, you know, entertainment companies are thinking about gaming, thinking about creators, like what's happening in the space. It was a really good interview. He's a fantastic, fantastic person. So I want to kind of gear us now into maybe talking about, we know our producer named this segment, What's Happening on the Internet? And I think that is like a big topic.
Implosion.
Yes. Splinter nets. But yeah, this is something that Lee, you and I have been talking a lot about. You're mm-hmm. very passionate about. You've made me passionate about it as well. Just kind of really keeping an eye on what's going on with everything here. Let's talk first about this lawsuit against YouTube that is being led by Steve Wozniak. Mm-hmm. It's set to continue. Can you fill folks in a little bit on what that is?
Yeah. So Wozniak is claiming, and this is basically what happened, scammers hijacked his YouTube channel. And he did not know that this was happening, and then convinced viewers that he was kind of behind a new cryptocurrency giveaway scheme or something like that, where users were supposed to send crypto to a completely unidentifiable location, and then they were supposed to get more than what they put in back. Obviously, this should be raising red flags, but when you are utilizing a person's identity to make this statement and they're in such high regard in the tech industry like this, I can totally understand why people would be like, well, if this is coming from Steve Wozniak, then it probably makes sense on a level I don't understand, right? Mm-hmm. And I actually think he might be the only person who has such a good standing in the technology space that even if I were to see this, it would make me go, what is he working on? Yeah. Not this is a scam. If you know me, I assume everything's a scam.
Yes.
but Wozniak's a different case. Like he has an upstanding identity in the space. There's a lawsuit that is happening from Steve to YouTube because he's claiming that while all of these people got absolutely nothing back and lost hundreds of thousands of dollars in this process, the lawsuit alleges that YouTube actually knew of this scam or of similar scams and didn't prevent them or even stop them from happening when they were going on. I'm excited to see this lawsuit. Because YouTube is broken. It mm-hmm. is busted. And it's something that can be fixed. Yeah. And it kind of takes some of this like legal finger pointing to say, okay, this is getting out of hand. Obviously, and this goes back to like what we were talking about, like where companies are responsible for the technology that they provide. You know, Google owns YouTube, and there's a lot of responsibility that comes with owning a platform as massive and user generated as YouTube. A ton. And honestly, I don't think YouTube on its own, without being owned by Google, could legally function. Mm-hmm. It takes a company that large to run just the legal team that's going to be necessary for something like this. But in the wake of all of the changes, I mean, we're seeing more and more stuff like this. They've had to make bigger pushes towards getting away from ad blockers. And like, if you're watching YouTube without an ad blocker right now, you know, the mm-hmm. ads that you're getting don't make sense to you.
Yeah.
Like they are not like good targeted ads. I get targeted ads on like Instagram and I'm like, yo, okay, that's actually pretty high. I don't mind it on Instagram.
That's the weird thing. I'm like, oh, I actually like shopping there.
Right. But, you know, I'm getting some, you're just getting weird crap on YouTube all of a sudden. And I think this is a solvable problem. I think it's fixable. Yeah. But like that is a breeding ground for a lot of these type of like weird scams. So to see it coming together, we'll see what happens.
Well, I'm don't get me started on the ads I'm getting on X, on Twitter. It's like, what is this ad? Like, this is, ridiculous. I'm like,
you're living, I think you might be living in an empty ocean full of bots.
I think so. I barely use it nowadays. Like, I do feel like the AI community is super active on X. Still?
That's because it's where all the bots are. Yeah, the AI.
AI community. Ding, ding, ding.
You nailed it.
That's fantastic. The logic there. I love it.
I'll tell you what I'm keeping an eye on right
now. What are you keeping an eye on?
Patreon.
Ooh.
I am watching, for those who have signed off on Patreon and been like, oh, it's just a play. Like I think everyone like understands why Patreon is there. If you're even remotely following this, it's where creatives can go and kind of self-publish their own, whatever it is that they do, their content. And you get subscribers who pay you $1 a month or something crazy like that, because they're just fans of what you put out. And as you put out content, they get exclusives, blah, 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 blah. That was the original like kind of YouTube Kickstarter hybrid that they'd come up with. But then they opened up free tier, right? You can be, if a creator wants to do X, Y, and Z and they want a free tier on that, which is really interesting to me because I'm not someone who is big on like, I don't want people subscribing like financially to me. I can support myself. I don't need that. And like, that's why I work. I didn't think Patreon was like a place for like myself, but as I'm looking at it and they're becoming a discoverability platform.
Yeah.
And I've deep dived into all of the new like tools and stuff that they've been putting together. And it looks like all of these people who were kind of like abandoning ship on YouTube because it's gotten worse, who've put in like a decade on YouTube or Twitch or whatever, are moving over to Patreon and just continuing it over there because they're starting to distribute and stream their own video and, you know, their own content and their own, you can put files. Like, so if you're a writer, like I'm a writer, you're a writer, we can like publish actual like EPUB books and PDFs and things like that. So it's kind of got things that YouTube doesn't do for people who don't just live behind a camera. But what really gets me here is it's technically not social media. We had this conversation last week of like, how do you define social media? This is not social media. This is just basically a publishing website that has a fan base growth mechanism. And as we see like things kind of boil down to where social media is starting to get age gated in states, we saw Florida, we see what's happening in Texas. And I think I recently saw something of like another state. I'd have to go back and check, but I think it was Kansas or something like that. Don't quote me on that. Like this is a snowballing issue with social media where they need to make a definition of this. And as far as I can tell, like, I think Patreon might be in the clear of this. This sounds like an ad for Patreon. It is not. This is just
go to I've my Patreon doing, and
yeah, I don't have, next, I don't, right? I do not have a Patreon like live right now or anything like that. I'm just looking at it and going, holy cow, the training wheels are off on this platform and they are going full steam ahead. And I honestly think that they're going to take a bite. I really do.
I think so. I agree with you. I mean, I see more and more of these platforms kind of, you know, really becoming extremely popular for creators, right? To get really tap into their audiences. And I think, I believe Kent Bai, who's very well known in the XR space, he's got the...
Fellow Portlander. He's out here.
Voices of VR podcast, which has had, I mean, it's been on, he's been doing it for
years. Oh, he's the OG.
Years.
He's had the VR pod, yeah, like he's
like 500 original. Episodes. I don't know. He's done so many episodes, interviewed everyone. I've been on his podcast. He's a great person. I believe he uses Patreon, for example. I think that's one of the first times I actually paid, you know, kind of something. So, love seeing how that's going to develop. I want to jump now into talk about hardware news, these sorts of things, some of the things happening there that I think folks listening to our podcast should know. You know, we always talk about, we don't always, but we most of the time talk about Apple and what's going on with the Vision Pro. Apple has actually recently sued a former iOS engineer for allegedly leaking Vision Pro information to journalists. Apparently, yeah, there was all sorts of text messages, and I mean, the whole expose was insane. So they have sued this employee for leaking the Vision Pro and also things about the journal app. Very interesting to watch this. I remember a couple years ago when I think I was still at Magic Leap. Magic Leap had sued a former employee that went on to create a different, like a mixed reality hardware company.
Yeah,
that's actually still around. There was a whole lawsuit with it. But yeah, I think this has happened before. It'll continue happening. And I wonder.
It's happened, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I wonder with the explosion of hardware and AI wearables that we're going to see and more people leaving to create startups, if we're going to see kind of an influx of lawsuits. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think that there may be. You have to be able to, from my understanding, and again, not a lawyer, but I seem to be talking about law a lot lately. You have to show some form of like damages so you can like at least show financially what number you're going for. Obviously there's a break of an NDA. There is a huge break of a non-disclosure agreement there. Obviously as an employee, that employee would be immediately let go, and kind of told to pound sand, I think. But to what number you actually go after that one? Cause you can only like, what are they going to do? Like how much can you really go after one dude? Can you really show what type of like financial liability that had an impact on the company? I kind of feel like getting fired for it is probably going to be pretty gnarly. But you know, at some point, like, yeah, that was stupid. That was like, you don't do that. And not just with Apple, but with like any company, I spent years at Intel. There was and are still things that I will not talk about. Like that's just part of the gig.
I know you don't. Yeah. There's things you're like, I can't talk about that. I'm like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and you move on.
Not even one of your best friends, okay?
No. Like,
so I get it.
It's one of those things where it's just like, that was dumb, and you're going to learn a lesson. I hope that they don't, like, go too far after the dude. Yeah. I feel like losing your job is kind of the end of it. I think they're making a point
yeah, with all the new things they're working on, all the generative AI things that they're going to announce. It was definitely,
and they have
a
history of, like...
Yeah.
They got a bad history of like leaks anyways. Like their tech does get leaked right before. And I've always been speculative of like if they're self-leaking.
Of course
for
they
the
do.
PR.
All these companies do leak stuff to certain, you know, friendlies. They want a good positioning or yeah, of course. I'm sure. But maybe this wasn't it. This was more someone taking the initiative.
This was legit. Yeah.
Taking the initiative without being part of the comms department. So interesting.
Speaking of hardware. We have to talk about Oregon. I've never been so proud of technology in my state. Last week we talked about, states creating their laws that are like dialing internet regulations are going to like create a splinter net. I love that term. That's fantastic. On the hardware side, Oregon, our Governor Kotek, signed a bill that bans tech companies from not allowing third party companies to get access to parts to repair. This goes to the right to repair fight that has been going on for years now. But not only that, you cannot use software to validate the parts, meaning, that's the biggie is like your firmware cannot say, okay, I'm looking at these things and this part is not an official OEM installed by, so-and-so at this company because you took it to like some mom and pop shop to actually get a repair that you can afford. That's big. The software part of it is big. And so a lot of people have said, why Oregon? Because I think people expected it to come out of like San Francisco. And I always get a kind of a kick like, we pretend like technology is either in Seattle or San Francisco and not in Portland, but there's a lot of technology in Portland as well, right? Like, so Intel's headquarters right there in Beaverton. It's massive. A lot like manufacturing plants, everything. That's how I got to Oregon, mm-hmm. was through that, you know, so which means that there are sub offices for AMD, NVIDIA, Lam Research, which is a lot of people don't talk about Lam Research. Like, they're the company that makes the stuff that makes chips. So they mm-hmm. provide for all chip manufacturing, not just Intel. Like, they're huge. You know, these legacy, what would I think people might consider it boring tech, is all here. But that also means a lot of firmware gets made here. A lot of this software that we're talking about does come out of here, and the things that would do the checks on where this, you know, how these things work. So Oregon's a great state for this to take effect, and I think they're well positioned to not only enforce it, but help it spread through the rest of the United States. Obviously, I'd like to see this happen on a federal level, mm-hmm. But this is a very good step in the right direction for the right to repair fight.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very interesting when you share that article. It's like, interesting. This is very, very interesting.
We sell a lot of tech. We sell a lot of hardware to like small studios, development companies, development teams. Oregon doesn't have a sales tax. So we have a lot of people come up from California and down from Washington to buy hardware in bulk. And then take it back home. It's because, like, especially like I went to Apple to look into the Apple Vision Pro, and they're just like chronically out of stock because production studios, those headsets are $3,500. They're not cheap. So when you look at what you're going to save on sales tax on that, a lot of people just come into Oregon, go to Portland's, you know, Apple store, snatch up 5-10 at a time and dip, because they're able to do that for their like small production studios. And that was the first time where I really had put two and two together of like how big of an impact our sales tax, our non-sales tax would be on just like small tech companies who are getting hardware. And it all comes together and it all makes mm-hmm. sense when you see it together. I'm a big proponent for right to repair. So this is a good step in the right direction.
Right to repair, right step in the right direction.
Yeah, like a lot of rights.
So before we go to Dispatch from the Fringe, I do want to bring up a kind of a gaming story, has geopolitical connotations, context, and second and third order effects that I thought was interesting. And we've talked about China a lot, right? We've talked about Huawei, we've talked about the Huawei cloud in China and all those sort of things. Now we're actually going to talk about Russia. Vladimir Putin ordered the creation of Russian game consoles. Steam-like cloud delivery and OS. I was just like, whoa, okay.
The best comment on that article that I saw, and I put it in the Slack channel, was, oh boy, everyone's excited for the Putindo.
very funny. I agree. Great play on words there.
It was great.
But yeah, I was like, wow. I mean, to me, it was like two things. First, Putin understanding the power of gaming, and there's a lot of gamers in Russia, a lot of, you know, people are in Russia working technology as well. But then the other side is like the geopolitical context of like the fractured, if you start to create like Russian game consoles and Russian games on Russian Steam, like you start to kind of like take people away from the certain ecosystem, right? So I don't know. What do you think?
They've got a long history in this, and it's been tumultuous to say the least, because of a little puzzle video game circa, what was it, 1983, called Tetris. Tetris, Alexei, I never get his last name right, Pavlov, I can't pronounce his last name. But I do think he's up here in the Pacific Northwest of all places now. He was the creator of Tetris, and it was for a long time owned wholly by Russia. Like, that was a government owned thing. You had to license it unless it was like illegally pirated or an illegitimate copy. It was licensed from Russia. If anyone hasn't seen the Tetris movie on Apple TV, watch it. That movie is wild and way better than it had any right to be. I loved that movie. But seeing how they're geopolitical standing has been, if they're going to, there's so many blockades up for getting content and brands or anything over there that if they're going to have video games, like, yeah, they actually have to start making it in-house. I think that that's probably happening on a broader scale mm-hmm. for a lot of things, not just games. But this was the latest of them saying, okay, we have to do this. Now, are they going to be successful? I don't know. I don't know if you can do that, because you have to still get components that you can't just like demand you start making chips. Right.
Yeah.
Like that has to come from a legacy of people who know how to do those things. So in the US, we've had Intel. They were one of the first, and they've grown over the decades. And, you know, you can get your chips made in the Asian market from China or wherever. But you can't just like say, oh, we're going to go full steam ahead and build a video game industry with hardware, and we're all going to do 100% of it in one country. I guess we'll see.
We'll see for sure. So, we do have Dispatch from the Fringe. Our producer Lily is back, and she's going to be talking about wearable tech for nightmares. So take it away, Lily.
Hello, Kathy and Lee. In this week's Dispatch from the Fringe, I have a story about nightmares. Actually, it's a wearable technology that helps you fight nightmares or wake up from them before they totally ruin your night's sleep. It's a technology that's been around for a few years. It was approved by the FDA in 2020, and it's called Nightwear. It works on Apple phones and watches, and it's prescribed by doctors for patients with PTSD. But it has the capability to help anyone who has persistent nightmares. And I thought it was cool because Nightwear uses the different sensors in the Apple Watch, the heart rate sensor, accelerometer, and gyroscope, to detect a nightmare and then disrupt it through haptic feedback. So it kind of wakes you up a little bit to get out of the nightmare. It generates gentle pulses on your wrist via the watch that gradually increase until you are roused from your sleep. Roused from your nightmare, but not roused from your sleep. The concept was based on the way a service dog gently nudges its owner to help stop a nightmare. And I thought this was a cool story to share about how wearable technology has many different use cases, and that we're on the cusp of exploring even more wearable tech in our lives.
All right. Well, Lily, thank you so much for bringing us that Dispatch from the Fringe. I know folks love that segment. But yeah, we're at the end of the podcast. Lee, thanks for joining me.
Every time. This is like the highlight. I love doing this.
We have such a good time. And we're really good friends too. Like, I think people know that. But yeah, like, we're always literally chatting all the time on Slack. So
we've been getting a lot of like good responses. I get like messages on LinkedIn for the podcast too. So I really do appreciate that. And keep sending the messages and get on there, write some reviews, and hopefully give us some good ratings.
Sponsor the podcast. We love our sponsors. So all right. Well, thanks everyone for joining Tech Magic. Come for the tech, stay for the magic. We'll be back next week.
Hey there, podcast fam. Are you ready to break free from the social media rut? Hold on to your hats, because we've got just the thing for you. Meet Viral Growth, your one-stop shop for leveling up your online presence. Whether you're a personal brand or a company, they've got the tools and know-how to take you to the next level. With Viral Growth, forget about those endless hours of video editing. They handle everything from brainstorming to polishing your content, so you can just focus on being awesome. And guess what? We're hooking you up with a sweet deal. Use code ADWEEK for 10% off when you sign up. Ready to take your social media game to the next level? Head on over to viralgrowth.io and let's turn those digital dreams into a reality.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.